health is wealth, and this is where we're going to talk about it. The Small Conversations for a Better World podcast with hosts Jillian McCormick and Susanna Steers. This podcast represents the opinions of the hosts and or their guests to the show. The content is for informational purposes only and should not be taken as medical advice nor established legal standard of care. Hello, everyone, and welcome. Today, Jillian and I are having a small conversation with a very special woman whom I met on Instagram, of all places. In my work as a movement specialist and Pilates teacher, my interest has always been in how I can support people in doing the things in life that are most meaningful for them. For me, it's not about flat bellies and six-pack abs or the perfect roll-up or any of that. It's about creating new strategies and helping people to build new strength, stamina, and resilience, so they can find ways to navigate the important stuff in their lives with ease, with vitality, and yes, I'll say it, joy. And so often, beyond the exercises and the protocols, it's the connections we make with people that contribute most to success. So, a little over a year ago, when I was scrolling through social media, bored to tears with the endless litany of perfect exercises for this or for that, and I was somewhat intimidated by the parade of beautiful bodies, I ran across the Instagram feed for Vancouver-based occupational therapist Karen Gilbert. And this woman was speaking my language. What I saw in her Instagram feed was a woman who clearly has a deep care for people and the challenges that they're going through. I saw a certain synergy in our approaches, a reframing of problems, finding new support strategies, letting go of perfection and dealing with what is, and all of these based in love. So I reached out. I had to learn more. Karen Gilbert helps people juggling a busy life and an invisible health condition develop new strategies and habits for living with greater ease. She is also a certified Daring Way facilitator and leads Daring Greatly and Rising Strong groups based on Brené Brown's research on vulnerability, courage, shame, and worthiness. Karen is passionate about the interplay between our physical, emotional, and social well-being and empowering people to engage in activities that are meaningful to them and maintain a sense of worth and identity during vulnerable times. She's been an occupational therapist for 24 years and works with individuals who want to develop strategies to make the most of their time and energy, sleep more soundly, reduce isolation, stress, anxiety, and pain, improve attention, memory, or organization, and do more of what lights them up. In the relatively short time I've known Karen, we've had some really juicy conversations about a lot of things, and I'm really excited to dig into some good stuff with her today, too. Welcome, Karen, and thanks so much for joining us in the studio today.
Well, thanks so much for having me and for your very generous introduction. I echo the same thing back to you in terms of feeling the synergy in our work. So I'm really excited to have the conversation with both of you today.
Okay, so I have to admit that as a physiotherapy student, in a faculty of rehabilitation medicine, so I went to school in a building that was educating OTs, PTs, and speech therapists. I asked repeatedly over the course of the 5 years that I was in this building, my OT colleagues, what it was they did and were learning. And often they couldn't really give me a clear answer. It was like it was really hard to define what OTs do, like no pat answer. I think it probably speaks to the vastness of our human occupations and the myriad ways that one might interact to help people function better in their chosen environments with all the parts of themselves that may perhaps be described as unchosen aspects in their chosen environments. Can you speak to what it is that occupational therapists do? What do you do?
Okay. Thanks so much for asking the question, Jillian. It's, it can be something that's hard to really, you know, put your finger on, because I think the specifics really depend on the area that an occupational therapist is working in. So I think it can be helpful to kind of back out a bit and look at the greater philosophy about why occupational therapists do what they do. So all OTs, all occupational therapists have that core aim of empowering people to do the activities that they want to do or they need to do, and that are meaningful to them. So even just the word occupation, I think, can be misleading for people. So in this context, we're really, you know, we're really referring to the activities in your day that occupy your time. So that word has really become synonymous with career in our modern world, but we're really talking about all the things that a person does in a day. So when someone has an illness or an injury or they're going through a life transition, occupational therapists are trained to, you know, to really listen to somebody's story, to understand what has changed for them, what their struggles are, you know, who they are as a person, what really matters to them. And so we look at how, you know, how somebody thinks or how they move, what sensory inputs their nervous system likes or it doesn't like, what causes them stress or anxiety, and how all these pieces operate together in the spaces and places that that person goes in their life. So whether that's work or home or the things that they do for fun, the places where they connect with the people that are important to them, we don't see any of those factors in isolation. So it's a it's a very whole person, whole life lens. And then our role is really to support people to get past the things that are getting in the way of whatever it is that is important to them that they want to do. So often that's through developing strategies to either compensate for whatever the struggle is or looking at interventions to improve, you know, whether that's a physical, mental, emotional, social struggle. So the approach will obviously be very different depending on where somebody works and depending on who the person is that they're working with. So whether, you know, whether it's an elderly woman that's had a stroke or whether it's a child that is struggling with handwriting or, you know, a man in his 50s who's having difficulty with concentration or memory, the pieces that we're looking at and integrating together will be very individualized.
I think that's really interesting to hear. There aren't that many professions that have the word empowerment in the description.
Hmm. And to also consider the wide array of factors that you are looking to integrate. It's not just, I think probably the three of us in this room are all looking at whole body approaches. Hmm. But you know, getting into the whole
biopsychosocial.
That's the one. Getting into that whole piece, but it's interesting that specifically the occupational therapist, the role in and of itself, is about integrating all of those pieces for somebody, mm-hmm. helping them to find those integration points.
And I think one of the pieces that, you know, that occupational therapists bring to the conversation or the health team is that, you know, we are looking at all those pieces for the person, but it's within the environments that the person lives in and then also right. the tasks that they, you know, the occupations, the things that are important to them that they want to achieve. So it's the interplay between all of those things. Mm-hmm. That really, you know, really leads us to the interventions or the strategies that we might come up with for someone.
In a really functional way.
Yeah, in a really practical way. Would it be helpful to kind of talk through an example?
Sure. Let's do it. I certainly want to point out that these OTs that I went to school with were there for the same length of time that I was there for. So that at the time was a 4-year undergraduate degree. Mm-hmm. It's a profession based in hard science and very clear medical knowledge. When you see an OT, you're not just going to a life coach that took a few online courses and has some experience. You're going to have a very different experience than that. So I think it's important to point that out.
Thank you for acknowledging that. So yes, occupational therapist. Now it's a master's program. When I went through, it was a bachelor's, but we were in the anatomy lab. We were in the neuroanatomy lab, mm-hmm. Really looking at the science, at the specifics. It's an evidence-based profession, that we need to really look at those individualized human factors, but it's all informed by science and what the literature and, I think people's experience brings to the conversation as well.
Mm-hmm. Are there specialties within the profession for occupational therapists, or directions that you go in once you graduate? You've just described something that sounds really vast, and I've seen OTs in hospitals when I worked in public health, mm-hmm. but I've also met OTs that work in private practice. Are there specialties? Are there post-grad options?
So people, you know, people tend to end up with an area of specialized knowledge as their career progresses. And, you know, as you mentioned, OTs work in many different areas and across the lifespan. So, you know, right from working with infants and young children to working with older adults, it might be in an acute care hospital setting, as you mentioned, rehabilitation centers. It could be in people's homes in the community or on mental health teams or outpatient clinics, private clinics. You know, I've seen a few OTs actually through social media doing nature-based therapy. So, you know, in the outdoors. So, yeah, the scope can really be quite diverse. But in all of those areas, the OT is, like I said, they're looking at all those different components that go into the activities that we do as human beings. So I think that, you know, the real core philosophy of occupational therapy is that participation in valued and meaningful activities or occupations is essential for well-being. And so we're using that not only as the outcome, not only as the goal that we're working towards, but also as the means to achieving it. So it's through those, you know, through the activities that we do in a day that we come up with the interventions.
And how did you find your way to occupational therapy?
So I have kind of a fun story actually about my path to finding occupational therapy. If you'd asked me after I'd been working for a few years when I first heard about occupational therapy, I probably would have said it was in my final year of high school, sort of looking through the, you know, the university course guide. And then I promptly went to the Encyclopedia Britannica, as you did in those days, and was quite intrigued by what I read. I should probably go back and read that again to, you know, to see what spoke to me at that time. But the interesting part of the story is after I'd been working as an OT for about 5 years, my parents were cleaning out their garage, and we were each allowed to keep two boxes. So here I was in my parents' garage, you know, going through all these old boxes of stuff from elementary school, like old art projects. And I, you know, I came across, do you guys remember Key Tabs? It's a workbook that we used to get in elementary school. And so that like they always had bright colors on the front. Yeah. And so I opened up this Key Tab, and it was from about grade six. So how old are you in grade six? Like about 11?
10 or 11, I'm guessing.
10, yeah, 11.
And we had to do an assignment where we went to the newspaper, again, as you did in those days, and cut out ads for jobs. So the assignment was to look at, you know, what were the qualifications and what was the application process. And so there in front of me, you know, pasted into this elementary school workbook was an ad for an occupational therapist at a major health organization in the Lower Mainland. And the other one I cut out was a social worker at the organization that I happened to be working at the time, and actually that I've worked at for the past 25 years. So,
oh my God!
Yeah,
it was fabulous.
My jaw was just dropped, right? So, yeah. So there was either a seed planted much earlier than I, you know, had originally realized, or my interests were really showing themselves at a much earlier age. You know, I think it all kind of points to my discovery, whether it was, you know, looking up OT in the Encyclopedia Britannica or the, you know, the university guide, or, you know, as I learn more about the profession. I think probably at all those points, I really realized that the philosophy of OT really aligned with my own values. So honoring people's stories, empowering, as you mentioned, you know, people to live well and lead healthy and fulfilling lives, and really, you know, really to support them to discover what that means for them.
Karen, can you tell us a little bit more about your work as an OT?
Yeah, sure. In my private practice, I often work with people who have invisible health conditions that aren't readily apparent to those around them. So people are often struggling with things like fatigue or pain or anxiety. It might be things like memory, cognition, concentration. I also do a lot of work to help people improve the quality of their sleep. And as you mentioned in your intro, I lead groups based on Brené Brown's research around vulnerability, worthiness, shame, and courage. So the people that tend to come to me are they're usually pretty self-aware, and they've done their own exploration and have received, you know, all the medical information that's been offered to optimize their condition, but they're still really feeling stuck in terms of their day-to-day routines and activities. Or people can be seeking input or seeking more input about their condition. So that, you know, that comes up with sleep, with people really wanting to look at practical strategies of what they can do in their day-to-day routines to improve. So I use a self-management based approach. Okay. So it's really about helping people to figure out what they have control over and then supporting them to develop, I often refer to, a toolkit of strategies and building habits that will allow them to optimize their experience in any given situation. You know, most of us know the basics about how to live a healthy life. We all know we should exercise and eat healthy and manage stress and get a good night's sleep. But if we also look at our, you know, our own values and preferences and how our bodies and minds respond to different sensory inputs, as an example, we discover a whole bunch of other experiences and activities and practices that can further optimize our, you know, our well-being and our ability. So behavior change is really at the core of this. It's about applying and integrating all of these things into our lives that really makes a difference.
That's great. And I imagine that too would be figuring out how to cope if it, you know, it's a different story trying to manage your sleep situation when you're on your own, or when you've got a family around you and everybody's got different bedtimes, mm-hmm. and, you know, sort of learning how to manage all of those pieces too.
Yeah, so great example of how somebody's social environment comes into what you need to take into consideration with an intervention.
Right.
Yeah.
So what is an invisible illness? We've talked a little bit about that, but in practical terms, what is it and how prevalent are they?
So invisible illness is really an umbrella term, and it includes a whole spectrum of conditions that are not immediately noticeable to other people. So examples would be things like chronic pain or chronic fatigue, also known as myalgic encephalomyelitis now. It is a mouthful, but it, you know, speaking to that condition, it's a much more or closer representation of what the physiology is, I think, in that situation. You know, other invisible health conditions or illnesses are things like concussion or brain injury. It might be something like ADHD or depression or anxiety. Something like cystic fibrosis would fit under that category, or some cancers are, you know, invisible. Sleep disorders are invisible. And many times people will have a few things together. They might have a physically based condition that's leading to fatigue or pain, and then have, you know, some depression and sleep difficulty kind of layered on top of that. So sometimes they can be quite complex and, you know, have many, many pieces to them. And you'll see, in terms of prevalence, you'll see different terminology used. So invisible illness is one of them. Invisible disability is another term that you'll see used. And that's when the condition impairs somebody's day-to-day function. And I often use invisible health condition. And that's because I work with a lot of people who wouldn't necessarily identify with having a disability or even consider themselves to be ill.
Right.
But whose health and wellness are really being impacted by something that other people can't necessarily is going on. So, or, you know, can't necessarily tell is going on. I think the distinction is important because words are so powerful in how a person defines their story. And I just want to be, using the same terminology that the person is comfortable with and not using words that for some can feel like labels. So So it's difficult to answer your question about prevalence. It's difficult to get accurate numbers, but some stats estimate that close to half of the population has a chronic medical condition that would be considered invisible.
Wow.
So
yeah.
And
I can see that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. I think it really depends on the terminology that we use too. So if we use invisible health condition to answer this question, and we think more broadly to include people who are struggling with emotional and physical well-being, but don't necessarily meet the criteria for an official medical diagnosis, I would guess, this is all of us. Mm-hmm. At certain points in our lives, right? It's really on a spectrum, and where we put ourselves on that spectrum of health will be individual based on what our lived experience is at any time and sort of what our story is at that point in time.
All of us.
All of us.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So, how would the fact that an illness is not easily visible to others affect both the person who is dealing with a health condition, and how does that affect their treatment? I suspect that there are probably a lot of people out there who are like, I'm just as happy that nobody knows I got something going on, and I'm going to keep it that way, thank you very much, because I can handle it, and I'm out in the world doing my thing.
Or it's really vulnerable to share it in your work environment, yes, or, with certain people who, it may just feel like too vulnerable a thing to divulge.
I have a close person who has dealt with learning disabilities through most of her life and has found brilliant ways to manage. Mm-hmm. Later in life, went and had some testing that identified the depth of some of those learning disabilities. But over the course of this person's life, she's developed amazing coping skills. Mm-hmm. But at this time, she was dealing with a bunch of things and was given a letter from whomever does the testing and whatever the body was that did the testing. And she looked at the letter and she said, I can't take this to work. It was one, there were a number of things that were suggested that she do in her work environment. Mm-hmm. And her first thought was, I can't take this to work. Mm-hmm. If I took this to a new employer, I would never be hired. Mm. And so it just sort of made me think of it when you were saying, it is a vulnerable thing to share in a lot of different scenarios.
Mm-hmm. If you look up invisible illnesses in the literature, two of the main areas that can come up are work accommodations and to disclose or not to disclose. Mm-hmm. So just the fact that that's something that people are researching, it's a concept that is really impactful in how people navigate in the world when they do have something that people can't necessarily see.
I think that's a powerful word right there, disclosure. And it starts you thinking about possible implications of admitting in not just professional situations, but also social situations. I'm sitting here just thinking about the fact that you can consider, say, it's a female and she has her menstrual cycle, and in the first 2 days of that, she has wicked cramps. That if she's not willing to disclose that at that moment for those 2 days, is that then an invisible illness or invisible health condition? Because it's impacting her experience of her world and possibly her ability to do whatever she wants to do at that time. But that isn't often something that a woman's going to stand at. Like, I have cramps right now, so I'm having a hard time concentrating on this meeting, and I can't really sit here. In fact, I need to go home and lie down. I just think it's, to your point about at various times in our lives, we all suffer from conditions that we would prefer perhaps to remain invisible or are just invisible by their nature.
Yeah. So I think we need to be really careful to, again, back to terminology, because, some of these things are just part of being human.
Correct.
It's not necessarily an illness. Yes. So It's such an individualized thing too, in terms of what somebody's comfortable sharing. I think of Brené Brown's wisdom about we share a story with those who've earned the right to hear it. And I think everybody's got different boundaries in terms of what that looks like for them and what that means and what the implications of that, might be in different situations. So yeah, there might be certain situations where that's really helpful, you know, for the really close friend to know why that person is not able to, come out for dinner that night because she's having, really major cramps and is not going to be able to be present at the conversation and really needs to stay home and take care of her body that night. But there's going to be other scenarios where that's not going to be as comfortable for her to bring that up and talk about the details of her experience. And like Sue said, it makes more sense to keep that to ourselves and attend to what our body needs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And we've spoken just a little bit about Brené Brown so far, so I thought maybe we should clarify that a little bit for anyone who might not have heard of her. Brené Brown is a researcher and best-selling author. She researches shame and vulnerability and is applying the things she's learned to corporate and individual coaching and leadership. Her 2010 TED Talk on the power of vulnerability has over 44 million views.
So I didn't know about Brené in 2010 when she did her TED Talk. She's been around for a while, but I didn't know about her then. I think I only found her about 2 or 3 years ago. And I have to admit that I have a certain reticence, a suspicion about folks who want to self-help me. It makes me angry in a totally immature way. We could talk about that another time. But so I went into even reading a book about her or watching her TED Talk with like a really, and in spite of myself, I loved her. Every time I listen to Brené do an interview or a TED Talk or her Netflix special, I feel heard and felt in 1,000 different ways. Just listening to her and moving through whatever stories she tells leaves me feeling more grounded. I mean, that is an amazing superpower. So how did you become aware of Brené's work and what led you to study and become a certified practitioner?
So that TED Talk was my first introduction to. So the power of vulnerability when it came out in 2010. And at that point in time, I happened to be going through a really difficult time in my own life. And so could really identify with that, with vulnerability and, that feeling of not being enough. And just had one of those moments, like you so articulately described there, Jillian, that I knew this person was speaking truth about our experience as human beings. So I was just hungry to understand on a deeper level about her research and then also really how to apply it. Because I think in that initial TED Talk, we hear a lot of the concepts that we relate and go, yeah, I've felt that, I know that. But at that point, I didn't really have tools. It was like, what do I do with this? Okay, I know this stuff now. You're putting language to it. But how do I work with this? How do I talk about it? How do I further understand how this can impact my own life and then also my work as an occupational therapist? Because I could see some of the things she was talking about that would impact the clients that I was working with too. So by 2013, the opportunity to become a certified facilitator had been developed, and I kind of happened upon it online, and so was super excited about that and applied, and then headed to San Antonio in February of 2014 for a 5-day training. So basically at the training, we went through, at that point it was the Daring Greatly, curriculum. So we're going through the curriculum ourselves personally while learning to facilitate it. So it was a really transformative experience, both in the impact that it had on me personally, as well as, boosting my own kind of personal resilience toolkit. And then also really having language and metaphors which I think are so powerful. I think that's why her work has resonated with so many people, is that it's accessible. She talks about these things in a way that makes sense to us. So the concepts from her research come up often in my discussions with clients around vulnerability and owning our stories and giving ourselves permission to be imperfect and be enough just as we are, even if we have a health condition.
So how does some of those things play a role in the health of an individual or the recovery of an individual? We're talking about shame, vulnerability, armoring, worthiness. What the heck does that have to do with someone who's trying to recover from something? I mean, don't they have enough to think about just recovering?
Yes. Absolutely. that's a big question.
Sorry,
lots of pieces to it. So why don't let's start with a definition, because I think for a lot of us, even just hearing the word shame can make us recoil and, you know, want to keep our mouth shut and run. So let's start with a definition of shame. So Brené would define shame as the intensely painful feeling or experience of believing that we're somehow flawed, and that would make us unworthy of love and belonging. So really it's the fear of disconnection, that if people really knew our story, I think we get back to our conversation about disclosure here too, right?
Yes.
That if people really knew our story, that we would no longer belong, that we would no longer be accepted or loved. And physiologically, shame, it's a trauma response, right? It's the brain interprets it as danger to self.
Danger.
So it's that whole cascade of protective responses are activated, you know, not unlike when we have a physical threat to our body. So it creates that sympathetic activation, that fight, flight, freeze response in the nervous system. And we know over long periods of time that creates a chronic, you know, pattern of chronic dysregulation in our nervous system, our immune system. There's evidence that strong emotions like shame increase inflammation in the body. So if we already have a health condition going on, and then we layer on this emotional response to it that creates this whole physiological cascade within our body, we're layering on more suffering, more challenge, more for the body to work against in terms of healing and recovery. And that's not even to mention the sort of the in the moment physical effects of fight or flight, you know, things like reducing blood flow to the brain that, you know, makes it harder to think and focus.
Harder to make decisions.
Yeah. Or impairing our sleep. So, and then we know that impaired sleep is connected to increased pain levels and, you know, decreased healing repair of the body. So it really becomes part of a vicious cycle.
So as you said, a cascade.
Yeah. And I think one of the other things that's really important to point out is that health is one of the main shame categories. So it really deserves our attention in this conversation about health. So in Brené's research, there was 12 shame categories, and you know, we often like to kind of tuck these things into the corner of our mind and think that they don't really apply to us. But I think that's the other thing to know about shame is all of us experience it.
Yes.
It's a universal human experience. And the tricky thing about it is that it makes us not want to talk about it. It makes us, you know, want to hide and
hide,
seek and keep.
Mm-hmm.
And the more we hide it, the more it impacts us. So one of the things we can do to be more resilient to shame is actually use the word, and actually talk about it. So the categories that came out in her research are, things like appearance, work, money, sex, aging, being labeled, and mental and physical health is one of the main shame categories. So it can come up for people, and I think we all know these experiences, even times when, you know, we have the flu and we have to call in sick to work,
letting people down.
Yeah. So even just things like being sick, missing work, having to ask for help or receive help, you know, canceling plans, showing emotions. I think all of us, you know, all of us can relate to times when we felt like we weren't enough because of those things. And then there's the fears of being, you know, being perceived in ways that we don't want to be identified with, like, you know, words like lazy or flaky or selfish.
Not having your act together,
right? Or being too sensitive. Yeah. Those things are a trigger for a lot of people. So if we're having this cascade of physiological reaction, and, you know, we're in a situation or have a condition where that's happening pretty often for us, that's really worth looking at.
Absolutely. So many things to say and think about right now. My brain's whirring away. You know, not to mention, there's no way not to connect a conversation about shame to your own personal life. You know, all the things that you're talking about, we're like, oh yeah, well, this year I needed back surgery. Mm-hmm. As a physical therapist, I can tell you that there was no shortage of confronting moments along the line of that journey for sure. Like, interesting. Many interesting things to contemplate there.
Well, so, it just goes to show that we can take all of those. We're talking about it today in the context of invisible illnesses, but certainly those are concepts that we can all take a look at in the breadth of our lives, the whole experience of our lives.
These concepts apply to being human, right?
Yes.
To be here and to be human is to be vulnerable. As we're talking about vulnerability, I'll give you another definition, because I think that's another one that's really important to kind of wrap our head around is, you know, what is vulnerability? Mm. And in the research, Brené defined it as uncertainty, risk, and emotional exposure.
Right.
That's so all the time, right? Like, yeah. Life is uncertain to be here. Yeah. We can't opt out. We can't opt out of being vulnerable just, you know, by being human and being here. And we can't opt out of feeling shame. So we're all going to, you know, we're all going to revert to those protective mechanisms. And I think, you know, as I heard you going, I think it's the practicing noticing when we're doing it, right? It's the recognizing the triggers and staying aligned with our values and staying connected with our authentic selves rather than going down the rabbit hole to try to avoid criticism or, you know, judgment from others or it's really putting some of these resilience practices into our day-to-day lives.
Yeah. Again, so many places we could go with this. I wanted to talk. I mean, we talked about the vulnerability, and I will admit there was a time in my life when I've actually said the words, "No, I don't do vulnerability."
Ooh.
Like, I've actually said that out loud. I've come a long way since I said those words, but
you are not alone. That is so in Brené's research, there was 4 myths of vulnerability, and one of them is I don't do vulnerability. So it was a
category.
Yeah.
Along with it's weakness, you know, and that we can opt out, and that it's oversharing. Actually, is the other one.
I like to keep things close to the vest, and Well, what I think in part of my explorations of some of the concepts around vulnerability and things, I started to really explore the idea of armoring. And it resonated when I was reading about this concept of armoring, and maybe you can speak a little bit to that, but it was really interesting to me to see how that shows up in my movement practice, both my own and with my clients. Can you tell me a little bit about how you see armoring?
It's a great question, and it's one that the actually having conversations with you, Sue, has led me to really kind of think about this on a broader level. So this is kind of a first go of putting some of these pieces together
so
in
a more
public way. But I'll tell you some thoughts. So armoring is really a form of protection. So there's lots of different ways that we try to protect ourselves from being vulnerable. And three of the ones that come up often are perfectionism, numbing, and what Brené has coined foreboding joy. So I'll break those three things down, and then maybe we can talk a little bit about kind of how that shows up physically. So perfectionism, a word that all of us are familiar with and maybe familiar with in our own lives, our own behaviors. We try to protect ourselves by doing everything perfectly, by, you know, looking perfect, acting perfect, saying the perfect thing in order to avoid the pain of judgment or criticism. So it's driven by what will people think. It's not driven by this is who I am and this is what's important to me and this is what's meaningful. And yes, it might be a little bit scary, but I'm going to, you know, stay aligned with who I am. And so by doing that, we kind of shrink down who we are, right? We end up hurting ourselves more than if we'd allowed a little bit of vulnerability, a little bit more freedom. So it's rigidity. So we can think about that in terms of the way that we think. And it's kind of I think in some of our conversations you've described sort of that overpower scenario. So when we're trying to think perfectly or move perfectly, we're going to be more constrained. We're going to be more rigid in the way that we do things, and we're not going to be able to tap into the vast amount of information that's available to us, both from within us and outside of us. So life is smaller. Life is not as rich
from some things.
Yeah, it's less free when we do that. Yeah.
I definitely see this in the clinic, in the physio clinic, in patients. Because I'm always looking at people's movement strategies. So your back hurts when you bend down to pick something up. So we need to see the way that you do that. It looks like you don't actually let, you know, X, Y, or Z part of your body move very much. And then it might be their shoulder, right? Not really related to why they thought they came to me for physio. But we have to allow them to move their shoulder differently. And they'll be like, wow, that really helps. Now I don't have pain when I do this. And, you know, I've never injured my shoulder, right? It's not necessarily about a past injury. Mm-hmm. And it can be sometimes a challenging concept for people to understand that perhaps what they do in relation to an emotion or a thought process will show up physically in their bodies.
Mm-hmm.
Because we are practitioners and we've spent lots of time thinking about this, are very aware that you just can't separate emotions, mental, and separate to that is then physical. That that doesn't work that way. They play back and forth on so many levels, even right down to that cellular inflammation level.
Absolutely, yes.
And sometimes that's a breakthrough concept for people. And can be like, it can be open the door to like amazing progress, but it can also be the place where they just are like, I just can't even wrap my head around what you're trying to say to me.
It's complex, right? There's many different pieces to it. So I think the chronic pain science is really on the cutting edge of pulling all those, you know, all those integrated pieces together, and helping people look at the impact of, you know, we spoke before about biopsychosocial, right? That it's all connected, and we can't take this one little piece of our system, whether it's emotions or, you know, how we move, and not have it impact all the other pieces.
And yet when we're trying not to feel shame and vulnerability and all of those things, we're madly compartmentalizing and trying not to let those things come together. Because if I feel this thing while I'm doing this other thing, oh my goodness, who knows what's going to happen?
Right. So we revert back to our, you know, our protective patterns in order to armor up and keep ourselves safe. So it's in the noticing that we're even doing that. And I think that's where, you know, working with practitioners that can help us tap into, you know, I think of the work that both of you do, in terms of tapping into that, you know, that subtle little moment where you have a different choice, you know, or you stop, or you apply, you know, a different sensory input, or you know, a different way of thinking about it, an image, in order to access something different in the body. So yeah, there's always possibility to shift and change what our patterns are. So yeah, so just to quickly acknowledge, so numbing, this is basically about, you know, taking the edge off emotions. And we do this in lots of different ways. If it's, you know, if it's compulsive and chronic, it falls in the addiction spectrum. So it could happen with things like food or drugs or alcohol or sex. But, you know, we all have ways that we take the edge off. So it might be things like surfing the internet for hours or shopping or, you know, endlessly researching. And that, you know, that can... I relate to that one too. You know, that can be a way to, you know, to not kind of be in the present moment and, you know, be with it, whatever's happening in our lives in that moment. So that comes up, you know, with that one, I think about fatigue management. I think about how we're using our energy in a day. And we, you know, if somebody's spending hours surfing the internet and kind of feeling crappy at the end of that, to really kind of back up and look at, like, what are your values and what's really meaningful to you? And yes, you're going through this really hard experience right now and you have a limited amount of energy, and how do you want to use that? So if we can kind of uncover things that we're doing that don't really fit with our values, that aren't meaningful for us, it leads us to opening up opportunities and making different choices, and, you know, having a more rich and full life with the energy that we do have. So, and I think physically around that, that's, you know, that's kind of that lack of awareness. Mm-hmm. It's that, I don't want to feel that. And so we, you know, we might just tune out, parts of our body. And so, you know, so that might come up too in sessions where it's like, oh yeah, somebody doesn't really have much proprioceptive awareness. And, you know, there can be lots of reasons for that. But yeah, if there's, sometimes that's connected to an emotional experience as well.
And I think it's interesting too, maybe to note that sometimes those coping behaviors that we talked about that can sometimes fall into the addiction spectrum or just whatever those tools are, they can actually be activities that the rest of the world sees as positive things. Mm-hmm. I'm going out and I'm exercising. I'm going out and I'm, you know, I'm losing weight. I'm
right.
Whatever those are on the scale.
Right.
People around you are going, hey, way to go. Right on. That's great. And meanwhile, you're diving deeper into the coping strategies. And I don't know, I guess they work for a while, but a lot of the time there comes a point where it's sort of a breaking point.
Yes.
And yeah, that whole strategy falls apart.
Yeah. You know, even just the culture of busyness.
Yes.
Of everyone saying, oh, I'm so busy. That's one of the ways that we numb, right? And mm-hmm. and we, it's almost at a point that it's sort of glorified, that it's like, oh yeah, I'm super busy. And I'm accomplishing all these things. And but if we really look at what are our values and what do we want to spend our time doing, how do we want to spend our lives, we might find that, you know, all that busyness is not actually leading us to where we want to be and what's meaningful. So the third one I'll just mention quickly, is foreboding joy. And this is really about, this is about trying to beat vulnerability to the punch. So Brené talks about joy being one of, or maybe even the most vulnerable experience we can have. So she gives the, you know, she gives the example of a parent standing over their child who's in a crib and just being so overcome with love that it, you know, it's vulnerable, right? Like to really feel that, of how intensely we can feel emotions. And then what our brain does is it immediately goes to all the bad things that could happen. So being aware of that and actually practicing gratitude in those moments is the redirect. So thinking physically, you know, that it may be that, and this comes up with people that experience persistent pain, is it might be that, you know, we're avoiding because we're worried of the bad things that can happen.
Right.
We don't try something, or we, you know, and then we end up missing out on, and it might even just be that, you know, the smallest little shift in movement or the smallest sensory experience, but we don't get that, you know, that moment of joy, of freedom, of experience, that we really need, you know, when times are tough. That all contributes to our resilience.
Yeah, my brain is going all kinds of places right now. and as you said earlier, sort of those moments of foreboding joy, I find sometimes when someone is able to put aside that pain signal for a few short moments and experience something different, it can be a really overwhelming moment. You know, that all of a sudden the possibilities and how did I get here? And oh my goodness, this feels great. But, of that rolled into one moment where you can just see the mind and body are blown and the circuits are all going haywire, and you have to sort of settle all that down a little bit so that you can find the fullness of the experience without all the alarms going.
Yeah. So really good point. So somebody's got to feel safe, right? It can feel vulnerable, but if it drifts into overactivation, then we're going to get back into that cascade. But if we can build our tolerance and our capacity to sit with that vulnerability and that excitement and that what if, and, you know, even just for a few seconds longer than we're used to, we build that capacity in our body and our nervous system.
Fabulous. We know that you lead Daring Way and Rising Strong workshops, groups.
Yes.
I noticed on your website that there's something called Wholehearted Living with a Health Condition Daring Way program. Are there any of those types of things coming up in the future for people to look into if they're curious?
If people are interested in finding out about upcoming groups, they can always sign up for the email out on my website to get on that list to be notified of when those things happen.
So we want to thank you so much for being on our show today to help shed light on the phenomena of invisible illnesses in the world. Early on in the process of getting ready for this interview, we noticed that you shared with us that you have your own definition of health on your website. And we like to ask our guests that exact question. Would you mind if I read the passage from your website?
Oh, please. Yeah, please.
So right from karengilbert.ca is, health is not the absence of symptoms. It involves participating in activities that bring meaning to our lives, surrounding ourselves with people that make us feel seen, heard, and connected, adapting to challenges, and making the most of our situation. I think that's a beautiful definition of health.
Me too.
Thank you for reading that.
So, Karen, after our discussions this morning, I'm just wondering if you could give our listeners a little something to take home. Is there something that you believe is the way that they could start to integrate some of your perspective into their lives?
Such a great question. You know, I think everything we've talked about today it's really about being human and navigating the ups and downs that come along with that, you know, all the imperfect messiness that being human entails, and really navigating through that the best that we can. So I would encourage people to kind of have a look at their own resilience toolkit. we know that if we can build skills and kind of get these things in our body and make them habitual before we end up in a situation where we really need them. And also to say that it's never too late. You can do this stuff in the midst of struggle, but we know that having it integrated can help people navigate difficulty more quickly and successfully. If they've started to think about what are some shame triggers for me, or we didn't actually get to talk about self-compassion today, but that's something that I work with almost all of my clients on integrating. So, really being kind to ourselves and giving ourselves the compassion that we need in those moments when we're not feeling like we're getting it from other places. So that can be just transformative in somebody's life, both in calming the nervous system and within our relationships. I think modeling that for the young people in our lives, right, can be really important, that self-criticism isn't necessarily the best motivator, and that self-compassion actually puts our nervous system in a better, in a better state. So just noticing, when some of those things happen, I think when we're all more compassionate with ourselves, we're more compassionate with the people around us, and the world needs more of that.
It certainly does.
Yes, it does. Amen to that, sister. Right on. All right. This concludes today's Small Conversation for a Better World podcast interview with the lovely and talented Karen Gilbert, occupational therapist, and Brené Brown, Daring Way facilitator. We hope you will join us next week for our next conversation.
If you liked what you heard, we encourage you to head on over to iTunes and leave us a 5-star review. Better yet, subscribe and leave a review. That really helps to make it easier for others to find us, to help broaden this small conversation.